Welcome everyone tonight. I'm very honored to introduce a very special guest. It's not the Dalai Lama, but the next best thing. Yeah, HHAA, visiting all the way from Northern California, where Ajahn Amaro is the co-abbot of Bayagiri Buddhist Monastery in Northern California. And I'm not very skilled with traditional New Zealand greetings. We're well suited for a hangi. And I just wanted to say how wonderful it is to have you here tonight. And Ajahn is going to be speaking on again, a very important topic, not holding to fixed views, and especially pertaining to full ordination of women in Buddhism.
Brahma Chilokadipati Sahampati Katanjali Andivaranaya Kata Santi the Sattaparaja Jakka Jatika Jesus Dhammang Anukampimang Padang.
Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. So often our teacher would begin a talk by saying that Dhamma talks are always given as reflections that are offered for consideration, and so I'll speak this evening in that spirit, please listen to what I have to say. These are thoughts to reflect upon, and that which is useful and helpful and which accords with what you understand to be true, then please take that and use that, and what you find does not accord with your understanding or what you feel to be good and true or useful, then please just lay that aside, especially in the spirit of trying to talk about not holding to fixed views, that I'm not trying to speak in a way that's saying, this is the truth. Just so it's in that context or that framework, I'd like to share some thoughts and reflections this evening. Considering this topic, was suggested by a combination of what came to my mind and what Ajahn Chandako suggested. One of the first things that popped into my thoughts was on the occasion of the previous World Abbots Meeting, when the gathering of the abbots of the various branch monasteries of Ajahn Chah's lineage from around the world gathered together about 4 years ago in Thailand at Wat Pha Nanachat, Ajahn Jayasaro, who's one of the monks, English monk of about my same sort of seniority, he was chairing one particular session, and he had the idea to ask all of the different people in the group what was the most significant teaching they remembered Ajahn Chah giving them, or that really stuck with them or struck them most deeply. And it was quite an interesting collection of recollections and memories that people had, and thoughts, teachings that Ajahn Chah had given us. But one of the most striking was what Ajahn Sumedho said. What he recounted was that one time Lumpur Cha had said to him, "The Dhamma is all practicing Dhamma is all about letting go. Practicing Vinaya is all about holding on. When you figure out how those two work together, you'll be fine." So I could just leave it there for the evening. So I'm partly tempted to, because Ajahn Chah was he's an amazing being in many ways, but he had, amongst his other many talents, he had this incredible gift for these nifty one-liners that encompass a whole huge range of knowledge and understanding and ways of working with life, just in a short, snappy phrase, and you always would think, well, how come I didn't think of that, or anybody else? But he was the one that came up with that, and it's very simple, but also extraordinarily profound and helpful in this particular area. So in many ways, when we talk about practicing Dhamma, that's essentially about not clinging. That when you look at the Four Noble Truths, we see the cause of dukkha is the quality of tanha, of craving, and that's its close relative, or also when craving is ripened to a greater intensity, it turns into clinging. And so it's often clinging that the Buddha speaks of as being the primary cause for dukkha, or that which is synonymous with what creates dukkha. And so thereby learning how to not cling is synonymous with freeing the heart from dukkha. And that when we talk about practicing Dhamma, it's also good to remember that another of the Buddha's teachings, and particularly staying at Vimutti Monastery, as also comes to mind, saying that the Buddha said that the purpose of it all, the purpose of the Dhamma teachings, the purpose of the Vinaya, all of this has one point. He says, just like this, no matter where you go in the world and you taste the water from the sea, it has the one taste of salt, so too, no matter what aspect of Dhamma or Vinaya you pick up, it has the taste of liberation, of Vimutti. That's the one taste of the Dhamma Vinaya, and so that in all its aspects, whether you pick up the Dhamma side or the Vinaya side, it should all have that one single taste, the taste of liberation. So that in a way that quality of liberation is realized or is come to by this aspect of not clinging, seeing where the mind gets stuck on to different aspects of life. And get stuck where the heart clings, and that the quality of liberation or enlightenment is seen over and over again, is talked about in terms of not clinging or freeing the heart from clinging. The clinging to views is one of defined as one of the four types of clinging, ditta upadana. And the phrase that we used as part of the title for the evening's theme, not holding to fixed views, that comes from a line from the Metta Sutta. Probably a few of you recognize that. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desire, is not born again into this world. So that's Ditinsha anupagamma is the line in Pali. Ditinsha anupagamma, not holding to fixed views, not clinging to views. And in those last lines of the Metta Sutta, whether the Buddha intended it to or not, but that seems to cover most of the four types of clinging. The clinging to views, not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desire. So that's clinging, being freed from the clinging to sensuality, kamupadana. And then the others are a little less obvious, but the other two types of clinging are clinging to conventions, to rules, or superstitions, to rites, observances, what's called silapat upadana. So this is silapata paramasa, is a term probably a few of you are familiar with in Pali. But it's one of the obstructions, one of the fetters that obstructs stream entry as well. So the clinging to conventions, to rules, to protocols, to the things that we determine into existence, we decide upon as being a standard, like driving on the left, driving on the right. Here back in New Zealand, you're driving on the correct side of the road, being English, but last back on the left. I live in California, where of course they drive on the right. So there's a certain sort of primordial sense of, we're back, things are back the way they should be. And it's only should be because I grew up in England and they drive on the left. And so there's that feeling of, this feels more normal. Even though I've lived in America for more than 13 years, that kind of basic habituation to a form driving is a kind of clinging to sila pata. The more usual ideas or experiences of clinging to conventions is things like the things that we give value to, that saying that this house is really worth $100,000 or $200,000 or oops, the market crashed, it's worth $15,000. You know, those agreements that what value a thing has, these are decided upon by human beings. They're arbitrary. And the last kind of clinging is attavada upadana. So in a way that I like to think of that, the phrase, the pure-hearted one, in that last lines of the Metta Sutta. The pure-hearted one having clarity of vision, so that the pure-hearted one being the one who is free from the clinging to the ideas of self. So clinging to views is, in a way, it's, of those four, it's in some respects it's the most tricky or the most difficult, because we are a thinking society. We love to think, and we are, as human beings, we are trained to think. We get through school and university. We hold down our jobs because of our abilities to think, to juggle concepts, to create ideas, and to defend them. The kind of school I went to, we even had a debating society, and you would pull a theme out of a hat, and then you would either defend it or oppose it, depending on which side you got picked on. So that then you were trained, or the competition was who could debate the most effectively, who could take just some random opinion that you didn't even believe in, and then vigorously defend it. It's like a lawyer is hired by a client, and forgive me if there's any lawyers in the room, but at least in America, the job of the lawyer, the mandate of the lawyer, is to vigorously defend the interests of the client. Whether it accords with reality or not is not the lawyer's job, but the lawyer's job is to vigorously defend the position of their client. So we love our ideas, we love our opinions, and our conditioning is to go along with the thought that if I think it, it must be true, right? And if somebody thinks different, well, they're just wrong. Is that a bit too much of a sweeping statement? It's certainly a trend that we have, that we tend to take our thoughts to be an ultimate reality, and we don't question that. And it was really striking to me when I first came to the monastery in Thailand. I really had no experience of meditation or Buddhism or anything of that nature. I was literally fresh off the beach when I walked into the monastery. I still had sand in my hair and a shell in my earring. I did. You can still see the hole. And so I was pretty new to the whole thing. And so I'd get into these conversations with the other monks and novices, and they kept saying, well, that's just your opinion. I said, no, it's not an opinion. It's a fact. And they say, well, yeah, that's right. You believe it's a fact. No, I don't believe it's a fact. This is actually true. And I began to hear myself saying the words actually a lot, and fact a lot, and you would always get this look from the other monks. They thought, oh yeah, right. And I began to realize that when you use the words actually or the word fact, you're actually often walking onto very tenuous ground. But our habit is to take hold of an idea or a feeling or a perspective, and because it's the way that we like things to look, or that fits our picture of the universe, we cling to it, we hold to it. And so that I couldn't get what they were talking about when they said, well, that's just your opinion, and you know, clinging to views and opinions is going to cause a lot of suffering. I thought, well, no, I'm not clinging to an opinion, I'm just right. And you're wrong. Can't you see? But then, and literally, I thought of myself as quite an intelligent person. I thought, oh, these people are stupid. I mean, I really loved the people and I loved the way of life. It was really an incredible breath of fresh air. It was really like finding a wonder, like a being tossed around in an ocean after a shipwreck and finding a really good piece of driftwood to hang on to that was going to help me survive. That was the feeling. But I couldn't get this thing about views and opinions. And after about a month or 6 weeks there, I found myself vigorously defending some particular point of view I had. And then as I was speaking, I suddenly realized, well, hang on a minute, this is a bit different from what I was thinking 6 weeks ago. So if I'm right now, if this is true, then what was the reality of things 6 weeks ago? If that's now wrong and this is now right, oh. if you do the sums on that, you know, you follow the logic, it's like, oh, so maybe what I'm thinking now is being so absolutely true, maybe in 6 weeks this will also be seen as something that's not quite right. Oh. Maybe this is what they were talking about. And I began to see this is what is such a powerful and seductive drug for us. We love our opinions and we believe in them. And we don't see this is just a mental creation. This is just something that's fabricated by the mind. It's a working hypothesis. It's a convenient fiction, as they say. It's something that we use, like deciding which side of the road you drive. I mean, if everyone could choose, you know, just chose their own side. I mean, any of you who've ever travelled in India will know there's a certain... it can work with anyone deciding to go wherever they want to. The Indian traffic world is a wonderful and amazing thing. But I think there has to be a certain kind of deeply rooted set of experiences to work in Indian traffic. You have to be deeply conditioned to be able to do that, to figure out what the rules are, how Indian traffic works. But most places in the world, you decide on a side of the road that you drive on, and then that makes it convenient for everyone. And that it's just an arbitrary decision in many respects. So that with opinions and views, it's seeing that just because we see that it makes sense, just because we can actually back up, actually, we can substantiate our opinion with facts, with data, with witnesses, written evidence. Say, look, see, here it says. Yeah, the Buddha said, look, here it is. And that it's not just the element of having some kind of pattern or way of seeing things fitting reality as we experience it, or we can back it up with other evidence, but it's the way that we hold it. That's the key thing. Because as Ajahn Chah would say, you can be right in fact, but wrong in Dhamma. And that one of the instances where he spoke about in that way was and a story Ajahn Sumedho tells of when he was a young monk, and there was a Thai monk who lived in the main monastery Wat Pa Phong, who was very loud mouthed and very very extrovert and seemed to be always just sort of opinionating about everything and being very sort of noisy and outspoken, which is very unusual for Thai people. It's very out of character for Thai people, but this fellow had a particularly sort of loud and aggressive and coarse manner with his speech. And Ajahn Sumedho suffered from being righteously indignant about many things. But this really got under his skin, and he thought, no one's saying anything. And Ajahn Chah, he's supposed to be teaching this monk, and he's kind of out of control, and everyone's just looking the other way, and this bloke is really making life a pain in the neck for everyone. Somebody ought to say something. And even though he was quite junior, he thought, well, I'm going to wait for my moment. And he collected all of this sort of incidents in his mind. He had a whole little catalogue of the worst occasions. And then he waited till after, when Ajahn Chah was away, and after the fortnightly recitation, when there's a, you know, you recite the rules, and then the senior monk says, anyone got anything to bring up or any business to discuss? Then Ajahn Sumedho, even though he's quite junior, and normally what happens when it says, is there anything to discuss? It's usually like, should we put a new roof on that kuti that's that's leaking? Or I think that we need to do more more work of repairing the wall outside the, you know, the front of the monastery. But Ajahn Sumedho said, yes, I'd like to bring up a particular matter. And he says, oh, okay, please speak. And so then he launched into this diatribe. And the other monk, miscreant monk, was right there. And in Thai culture, probably a few, maybe there's some Thai people here, and people know, being shamed publicly is absolutely the worst thing. It's like what you do not do. You do not confront people face on. It's just not the way you go about it. If I've got a problem with Ajahn Jodipala, excuse me, if I've unconsciously insulted him by saying Tan rather than Ajahn, and so I want to set Ajahn Jodipala straight or point out some kind of misbehavior, I would maybe look at Ajahn Chandako and say, you know, I really have a lot of difficulty with, you know, who monks who listen to Dhamma talks with their eyes closed. and I'm meaning it for the number two, but I'll say it to number one, so that then there's a bit of wiggle room. So that number two can think, well, he's not really talking about me. Uh-huh. And that number one says, well, it's not about me because I've got my eyes open. You know? So, or maybe, you know. But so there's a bit of slack in the system. But anyway, it was a direct confrontation, so it really put this monk on the spot. But all of his facts were correct. You know, he kind of recounted incidents and said who else was there and how this was embarrassing. It was in front of the lay people, and it was kind of making this whole kind of fracas. And so the monk was sort of looking vigorously at the mat throughout this whole thing, and then sort of at the end mumbled an apology and said, "I'm asked forgiveness from the Sangha. I'm terribly sorry." And then at the end of it, Ajahn Sumedho felt, oh, I did pretty well there. I think that's, at least that's out in the open, and we got things, you know, the air cleared here, and that's good. And he expected some of the others saying, well done, Sumedho, about time somebody said something about him. And we don't know why Lung Po didn't kind of set him straight. But even the other monks and the senior people just didn't really make much of it. Okay. Just made a minor slight acknowledgement of that, but didn't do any backslapping. Even monastic backslapping. And then a couple of days later, the monk had disappeared and left. And left the monastery. And nobody saw him again. So a few days later, Ajahn Chah came back. And as has been happening ever since the time the suttas were composed, they brought this matter to the Lord. The word reached the Ajahn that this particular monk had been chastised very publicly and directly in this meeting. Because normally, if you wanted to bring that kind of thing up, you'd say, I think the Sangha really needs to sort of look at their speech habits, and we need to kind of learn how to speak more quietly. And you'd make a point of not even looking at the guy and sort of speaking in general terms. But yeah, that hadn't happened. And so, Ajahn Chah heard that this monk was so cut up and embarrassed and shamed that he just packed his things and left the monastery and scurried away. And so he waited for a few days until there was a quiet time when he could talk to the young Ajahn Sumedho and said, Sumedho, I heard about the admonishment that you gave to Venerable so-and-so at the Patimokkha recitation. Well, you might have intended well, but you really acted inappropriately there. You know, because you meant well, but what you said and the way you said it were not anything that could be useful to him. And that's when he used this phrase: "You were right in fact, but wrong in Dhamma," because this was what I knew about that monk's speech habits. Of course, you'd have to be deaf or crazy not to notice. Of course I knew about it. But this was one of the few places that he could live. Of course he's annoyed everybody in every monastery he's ever been in. You know, he's driven everybody nuts. But this was the one place that he could stay and could actually practice meditation, practice Dhamma. And so, you know, you've driven him away. And I don't know where he's gone or whether he'll be able to find another place. So you've done wrong, Sumedho. You know, you caused harm with this, and you should acknowledge that to yourself, and learn to do better in the future. And he made a point of it. Ajahn Chah didn't do this in front of a whole gang of people, but it was just others. It was just the two of them by themselves. There weren't others around. And that he gave him that feedback, and he found it incredibly helpful, because he could see he's absolutely right. I was correct. I had all the facts correct, and I did everything sort of by the book. But actually, what I wanted to do was I wanted to set that other monk straight, because he annoyed me, and it wasn't about helping him at all. And so, it was not, as the Buddha said, practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. It was, you know, clinging to a view and then acting on it, and then being surprised at having a negative effect, or the not realizing what the negative effects might be. He thought that would be the best thing for everyone. So he really learned from that lesson, and it was and he's told that story many times. That's why I'm not telling it to embarrass Ajahn Sumedho, because he's told the tale many times. So practicing Dhamma is, in a way, is synonymous with learning how to not cling. And not clinging to views means to bring a certain spaciousness around our point of view and the way that we see things, or our preferred reality. And say, well, this is the way it looks to me, but others don't see it this way. And that it's almost like directly proportional or inversely proportional. The degree to which we cling to our opinions is the degree to which we'll create conflict with others. The degree to which we are able to see our own opinions, our own views, as views, and not cling to them, then that's the degree to which we'll find ourselves able to harmonize with others. Even if those views, those opinions, are very, very different, because not clinging to views doesn't mean to say views don't arise, or you don't give your life direction. It's not about being totally woolly. And I'm sure in New Zealand you've got some good expressions for being woolly. It's a sheep. A sheep-loving country, but you know, being kind of indecisive or vague or just not uncommitted. It's not about that. It's about learning to see how your perspective or your understanding of things is not the only point of view, and that for things to be both right in fact and right in Dhamma, there needs to be not only a sense of where you're coming from, but a sense of the people that you're working with, that you're living with, the people that you're talking to. So there's actually when you speak with others and you converse with others, it's not just a proclamation, but it's a communication. I'm sure all of us have been in those kind of conversations where you're just waiting for the other person to pause for breath so you can just carry on with your monologue. And they're doing the same thing, they're just waiting for you to pause so they can carry on. So you've actually got two monologues going, disguised as a conversation, and you're not really listening to the other person at all. And so what this is to do with is learning to listen, learning to not just hang on to our perspective and try to set the other person straight, but to really open the mind and see, well, why do they see it that way? How come they have a different perspective, and where is that perspective coming from? So this is particularly pertinent in these times, with this issue of a full ordination for women, and I'm sure most people have. I'd be very surprised if anyone who's in this room has not heard of the bhikkhuni ordination that was carried out in Bodhinyana Monastery in Australia on the 22nd of October, and then that. That was carried out by with Ajahn Brahm and the Brahm Wongso and the Sangha there, ordained four bhikkhunis from Dhammasara Monastery. That was done without the permission or having consulted with other branch monasteries of Wat Pa Phong or other Sangha members. Ajahn Brahm had informed Ajahn Sumedho a week before the ordination that he was going to do it. Ajahn Sumedho had, this was face to face at Amaravati Monastery in England. And I'm sure most of you know many of the details. Anyway, the fallout was that because this is an extremely significant issue, and there was no real consultation, it had never been discussed, the subject of bhikkhuni ordination had never been discussed at a meeting of the abbots of the Western monasteries, and it was on the agenda to be talked about at a meeting the World Abbots meeting that was due to happen in Perth in a few days' time. So that the fact that the ordination was carried out before we had the meeting threw a lot of people very off balance, and it seemed really extraordinary. And it's surprising that Ajahn Brahmawangsa would initiate doing the ordination before there was a chance to discuss that, such a sort of weighty issue. Anyway, I won't go into all the details. But the fallout was that because Wat Bophong had decided to go along with the Thai elders' judgment, that their view was that the full ordination for women could not be re-established in the Theravada countries, Wat Bophong had decided to go along with that judgment in a meeting earlier this year, I think June of 2009, that was the time it was discussed. So that in carrying out that ordination, Ajahn Brahm was going directly against a decision that was made by the main monastery, of which he's a branch. So that caused phenomenal ripples. And so he was asked to come to a meeting at the main monastery. And then at that meeting, the end result of it was that he was told that because he'd gone his own way with such a major issue and going against the decision of the main monastery, that he couldn't consider himself Bodhinyana Monastery a branch monastery of Wat Bophong anymore. So the ripples from both the ordination and that meeting have been reverberating throughout the Buddhist world for a long time. Now there are many different perspectives and aspects to this. For myself, I'll just speak personally. For most of the abbots and the people in the Western monasteries, it was not that Ajahn Brahmawangsa carried out the ordination that was out of order. It was how he did it that was the thing that caused the upset. That's why most people were sort of shocked and startled. It wasn't that people object to the full ordination of women in Theravada or see that as something that's impossible or inappropriate, but just the way that it was carried out, it was how it was done that was so sort of out of keeping with the way that our community functions. We're a very close outfit. Our branch monasteries are all very closely related, and we interact, and people travel between the monasteries all the time. And so it was, as the phrase has come to mind recently, is in terms of Ajahn Brahm carrying out the full ordination for women, was A plus for noble intent, D minus for diplomacy. You don't have to quote me on that, because his intentions I feel are extremely good. I think he has a sense for we are in the West, that the equality for women and men is required by law in the workplace. As everybody knows, if you look in any number of boardrooms, any number of collections of government ministers, things, that women are not represented equally in numbers, but the law requires that people not be discriminated against on the basis of gender, and just in the general attitudes and feelings of most people in most Buddhist groups, there is a very natural and widespread, if not universal, sense of the need to see women and men on an equal basis. And so that Ajahn Brahmawangsa carrying out the bhikkhuni ordination was very much in that spirit of trying to provide women a equal opportunity within the Buddhist tradition of Buddhist monastic training. I'm not an expert in Buddhist history, but my understanding is that the lineage of ordination has for nuns has been unbroken, as far as I can tell from the histories. The Chinese are extraordinary historians. They're the kind of number one culture for historical records over the centuries. They are really unsurpassed in that respect. And so, to give a little brief, my understanding of the history is that the Bhikkhuni order was started by the Buddha. His foster mother and aunt, Mahapajapati, was the first nun. And then the Bhikkhuni order was flourishing from the time of the Buddha. From reading the Sri Lankan records, I think the Mahavamsa, it talks about the time of Emperor Ashoka, actually the number of nuns outnumbered the number of monks. The numbers might be a little bit inflated, but the proportion is interesting. And that they say that at the time of the Third Council, there was 9,600,000 bhikkhunis and 8 million bhikkhus in India at that time. So the nuns outnumbered the monks in that era, according to the Mahavamsa. I think it's pretty sure it's the Mahavamsa. So then the bhikkhuni order was brought to Sri Lanka by Sanghamitta, the elder Arahant Sanghamitta, the daughter of Emperor Ashoka, and her brother Mahinda, Arahant Mahinda. And so that the bhikkhuni order was started in Sri Lanka at that time, in the era of Emperor Ashoka. It carried on and flourished there, and was still flourishing through up until about the year 1000 or so in the Common Era, just shortly after that. The lineage that of bhikkhunis that is alive today comes through China, and the first nun that was ordained in China was in the year 357 in the Common Era. That was a nun called Ching Qian was ordained. I believe the preceptor was Gunavarman, but she was ordained in with seven others, only by bhikshus. There were no bhikshunis in China. So it's what's called a one-sided ordination, an akanksika ordination, which is valid, but not perfect. So there were still validly ordained nuns, but it was not a perfectly done ordination, but the ordination still stands. During that era, then the first of the great Chinese pilgrims came to Sri Lanka, Fa Hien, in the early part of the 5th century, and stayed at Abhayagiri Monastery, which had 5,000 monks at that time. The nuns had that were associated with Abhayagiri had their own places. But Fa Hien, then seeing the nuns' community flourishing in Sri Lanka, then when he went back to China, he told the emperor that this was the case, and that it was possible to re-establish the nuns' order in China with a proper dual ordination, so that he had the emperor to contact the king in Sri Lanka, who was called Meghavanna, and asked if they could send a delegation of nuns from Sri Lanka, which they did, and that was headed by the Teri Devasara, and they left in 432. Of the Common Era, same year that St. Patrick went to Ireland, the Irish, just in case. It's a good year for the kind of carrying of religious teachings to other countries. Yeah. So in 432, then Devasara and 11 other bhikkhunis went to China, and they landed at Nanking, and then the ordination, a dual ordination was carried out for 300 bhikkhunis. Under the patriarch, who was Sanghavarman at that time. And then the records from that first double ordination and from the time of Ching Qian have all been kept in the Chinese books, and have been studied numerous times, and seem to be a thorough record, and they come down all the way into the modern era. That line is unbroken. And so then the ordination that was done in Australia, the Pavatini, the presiding nun, was ordained in out of the Korean tradition, but actually her preceptor was a Sri Lankan monk. She was ordained, had the bhikkhuni ordination in Los Angeles with a number of different elders, monks and nuns from different lineages, but she lived and practiced in the Korean tradition. So as far as I can tell, on the practical level of facts, that there's no fault in the line of the lineage of bhikkhunis coming down from Sri Lanka, and actually according to the Venerable Ananda Maitreya, who some of you might know, the Sri Lankan people, is a very wonderful elder who lived with us in England. He spent his 70th vasa, 70th rains retreat with us in England, teaching us Pali and trying to teach us Abhidhamma. Pali was more popular. But he said that the nuns who came to China were from a branch monastery of Abhayagiri. They were Abhayagiri nuns. And so that from my point of view and my understanding of the histories and also seeing Ajahn Brahm's accounts of the ordination procedure, personally, I don't have any problem with any of that. I think that was all, as far as I can tell, the Ajahn Brahm is a vinyadara. He's an expert in vinaya. It was the ceremony was done as probably as tightly as properly as you could do it, and that the lineage of those who are taking part in the ordination was as unbroken as any of us out of the Thai lineage can possibly say about the lineage of our ordination. So I have no argument with that at all myself. The question of the full ordination for women in the Buddhist world, and whether it's right or whether it's wrong, or should Kwo Pa Pong have been so blunt in cutting Bodhinyana Monastery off, or should Ajahn Brahm have been so blunt in carrying out the ordination without consulting his elders? Those are questions I can't decide for myself. You know, there are different perspectives. It's like a family that has lots of different members. You know, we're all parts of families, right? And different members of the family have different points of view and different reasons why they carry out different actions. What I can see is that the job that we have as monastics, and I feel Ajahn Chandako and Ajahn Jolipalo and those here have been trying to tread this line as Ajahn Pasano, who's the co-abbot with me and our community in the States, they're trying to tread the line of the middle way and really doing the best we can to come from this place of not holding to fixed views, not taking sides, not getting into the this is right, that's wrong, you're confounded, you got this wrong, no, I'm right, look, I can prove it, here it says, look, it's in the suttas, it's in the Vinaya, but more embodying the middle way. And one of the ways I like to reflect on this is, it's like it's to do with faithfulness, and to, on the one hand, to be faithful to our origins, to our past, faithful where we've come from, faithful to the lineage of those who've practiced and trained themselves over the centuries, given their hearts as monastics, as lay practitioners, who've given their hearts to this practice and training and embodying the Dhamma and the Vinaya of the Buddha, following the Eightfold Path, and out of a quality of respect and gratitude to our elders, to where we've come from, and and seeing that as enormously important. There needs to be a faithfulness to our origins and to our source. There also needs to be a faithfulness to where we live, who we are and what the present times are. There needs to be a faithfulness to the reality of the present. And so this is the big conundrum that we're all living in. It's like I can only really speak for myself. I can't even speak for Ajahn Jolipal or Ajahn Chandako or the other venerable sisters here, Venerable Tenzin Choki and our sister here. I can't speak for them as monastics, but just for myself, I feel it's this tremendous balancing act. And I try to see it as interesting rather than daunting, rather like the fellow on the wire between the two towers of the World Trade Center. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're 480 feet up and there's a lot of down. And then as your foot is about to go out onto the wire, there's that, But I see it's a balancing these two qualities of faithfulness and what's required of us. And I find the more that you let go and don't cling to fixed positions or fixed views, the more that you're really paying attention, then your foot can go on the wire, and then you, just like the walker up between the twin towers, yeah, he spent 45 minutes up there. He had a great time. For those of you who've seen the documentary about it, Man on Wire, but I feel like that. Like Jean Petit, I think is his name. John Small. John Small. Yeah. That there's a lot of down, but if you hold to the middle way, then you can come and go, and the passage is not difficult, but is also there's a kind of magic and a majesty to it. It's a balancing between the love and respect that for my teachers, my elders, for Lumpur Sumedho, Lumpur Liam, and all the Sangha of Wat Bapong, who I feel totally as my family, and Lumpur Cha, and Lumpur Man, and Lumpur Sao, all these great forest ajahns that have embodied the teaching and the practice, and just brought such an amazing presence of liberating teachings into the world. But also a faithfulness to the times that we live in, the people, the culture that we're in, and that that sense of respecting the values, and not out of any kind of pressure or being forced to, but just from a genuine natural sense, like, that it's completely, to me, it's completely natural and ordinary to think of women as totally equal. Someone was asking me, I really hope that you see men and women as equal. And as I read this was in an email, I thought, you know, it's so obvious to me that I never even think that thought. I mean, I grew up with a mother and two sisters. My father was often traveling and away, so almost my entire childhood and adolescence was in a house full of women. So I've always felt completely at home with the women's world, and that the sense of any kind of superiority, whenever I've met it or seen it, it always slightly startles me, like, what? I think, oh, right. He thinks that men are better. Oh, how strange. what a weird thing. So I'm not just trying to say, I mean, that's how it feels to me and how I experience it. It just strikes me as odd. Like, I'm always slightly taken aback when I come across that. It's like something can't quite comprehend it. But also, I am a faithful, card-carrying, robe-wearing, Theravada monk out of the Wat Bapong lineage, so that is the in a sense, the conundrum. The interesting conundrum is how to align and to be a place where those different qualities meet, where there's both a faithfulness to the origin, the source, which is totally sincere and utterly unambiguous, and also a total commitment to the times we live in and the society we live in and the mores of this particular society. I also think of it being like the job of a heavenly messenger. You know, the monastics are supposed to be the heavenly messengers, and the job of a messenger, a good messenger, not only faithfully gets the message and receives it from the source, but they also deliver it in a form that can be understood by the recipients. If you get the message from the source, but you don't speak it in a language or carry it in a form that can be understood at the other end, well, it's actually Macintoshes and PCs talk to each other nowadays, but back in the days when they wouldn't talk to each other, it's like having a file that was made on a PC and then trying to put it into a Mac and just getting word salad, you know, gobbledygook on your screen. But I have to think of another analogy. But when the messenger is faithfully carrying the message, but no one can understand it because it's not in a form or a language that anyone can comprehend. It's just sort of indigestible. Or if the messenger then doesn't like where the message came from, is so keen to get it to be understood, they completely scramble and change the message so that it'll be something that pleases and fits the ideas and feelings of the recipients. And again, they failed as a messenger. They might have carried their own opinion, but they haven't carried the message. And so, to me, part of what we're trying to do is, and the challenge of us in the monastic order, at least at this time, particularly those of us who are out of the Wat Bapong, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Sumedho lineage, is finding a way to be able to be faithful in both those respects. And just to finish with, one of the things that I found most striking about Ajahn Chah himself was that he was known as being an extraordinarily strict and proper monk. Here, his standards of Vinaya were very, very scrupulous and demanding. And he would pick up on the slightest detail of some kind of infraction. He would, be ready to point something out to someone or scold someone or make a 3-hour Dhamma talk out of somebody leaning on their arm while they're listening to a desana rather than sitting up straight. But he also was completely unattached to it, and that was my command of the Thai language was still is extremely rudimentary, but he taught kind of in a way that you could get a lot of the drift of what he was saying anyhow. And one of the things that was most startling was how he could sit up on the Dhamma seat and say, "There are no monks here. There are no nuns. There are no women. There are no men here." Like, you know, this is in a hall full of 200 or 300 people, so-called people. And he's absolutely sincere. There aren't really any monks or nuns here. They're no lay people. These are just conventions that we determine into existence. These are just designations. There's no absolute substance here. There's no real monk. It doesn't really exist. A person. There's nothing absolutely substantial. We call it a person. We say woman. We say man. We say nun. We say monk. But these are just conventions that we think into being and we agree upon, and we say English, we say American, we say woman, we say man. and he would say that with not trying to be clever or sort of trying to just be startling, but you know, it was exactly how he saw it at that moment, and that putting it across, saying yes, the monastic form is all and everything, and you've got to get it absolutely right. But actually, there is no such thing as a monastic. This is all just conventions. These are just the world of forms, and that we, if we don't see them as such, if we think that this is a monastic life, this is a monk, this is a nun, and this is a layperson, this is a laywoman, this is a layman, and these are absolute fixed realities, then we've lost the taste of liberation. We're just acting out particular protocols or forms, but it's not got that taste, the one taste of liberation. So that in that respect, if we're becoming bhikkhunis or bhikkhus in order to be a bhikkhuni or to be a bhikkhu, we've missed the point. You might think that sounds heretical, but I'm not, quite honestly, and I've said this numerous times, prior to these current events, is that I didn't become a monk in order to be a monk. I became a monk in order to be liberated. So that I am a monk, on the conventional level. I've got credentials. I've been doing this for 31 years. So, yes, on a conventional level, I am a monk. But I'm not a monk in order to be one. Does that make sense? And so that, to me, if women wish to take full ordination, and there's ways they can do that, really conduce to that quality of liberation, and don't just create more of an identity, or create more sort of division and confusion in themselves, or between them and their own kind of Dhamma families, then great. But if it's for a new identity, I want to become a this. This is what I am. Even though that might have some helpful social fallout, and that it can helps to break a mold which might be seen as restrictive or inappropriate. If that's the goal, is to become a new person or a new thing, then we've missed the point. It's not the Dhamma is not about becoming a different kind of a person, about becoming a Buddhist even. the practicing Dhamma and liberation is seeing beyond conventions, not attaching to views, not attaching to identity. atavada upadana, not clinging to the I ams, not clinging to the silabhata, the conventions and forms, the protocols, not clinging to views, not clinging to sense desire. So that if we really free the heart from clinging, then we can use those conventions with skill. We can be a bhikkhuni, we can be a bhikkhu, we can be a layperson, we can be English or a Kiwi or American. We can do the dance, but we're doing it without confusion. So not clinging doesn't mean to say throwing away. It's like Ajahn Chah would say, you know, when we want to use something, it's not like to say, I don't want to cling to this bell striker, so I shouldn't pick it up. It's like, no, if you cling to it, you create tension. It's by gripping it, I can feel the tension in my body. To not cling, you just stop clinging. I don't have to throw it away. It's like, ugh, evil bell striker. How dare you try to confuse me and tie me to samsara? You know? No, it's not from its side, it's not trying to cause any harm. It's just the way I'm holding it. So it's just relaxing that grip. So then when you need to use it, you can pick it up. When you don't need to use it, you can put it down. So I'll close my reflections for the evening on that and offer this for your consideration.
John, are you open to questions?
I am open to questions. Or disagreements.
With all due respect, can I just reflect back the first story?
Mm-hmm.
My understanding was that the monk had a very totally elephant mind or monkey mind that was uncontrollable,
mm-hmm.
which agitated someone who unskillfully challenged him
mm-hmm.
and sent him packing.
Mm-hmm.
The reaction of Dhamma was to be compassionate to both. And Ajahn Chah sounds to me, you didn't finish if he chastised him or not, but he certainly said, did you see what happened?
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't excommunicated for being clunky. And the other monk presumably, hopefully, came back to the Dhamma and was able to be embraced by people who could widen their heart and see his clunkiness and embrace that. Wouldn't that be exactly what's happened to Ajahn Brahm? He has, with good intentions, followed the precepts according to what he's researched and validated.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be validated by other people. And if men and women are equal, then he's providing that, albeit in a clunky way. And I don't think anyone argues that it was clunky. But why is he not given compassion? Why has he been excommunicated and ostracized and judged when his intention was to spread the Dharma and allow women to be liberated in your path?
Good question. You know, we have rules about not decrying or is the word decrying or not going against the decisions of meetings that you were at. But I wasn't at that meeting. Yeah, I wasn't at that meeting. I don't know. There is a transcript of what went how it went down. I haven't read that. I mean, there's just so much verbiage and spin. I mean, it's just the amount of. I thought we were trying to stop all the spinning, but the amount of spin that's been going. It's been kind of wearying, but you know, I'm conscious that this is being recorded, but and I'm not sure whether Ajahn Chandika would agree with me saying this, but I feel there might have been a degree of overreaction But I think it's important for people to understand that it's like if you went up to your grandmother and slapped her in the face, there would be serious repercussions. She would be shocked and hurt. And then why did she do that? And that, I don't live in Thailand. I'm English by birth, but from my understanding, from talking with people, and also just being Ajahn Pasano has lived in Thailand for more than 20 years, and so he has much more of a feeling for it. That's how it was felt. That's how this extraordinarily delicate issue that was acted on in a very summary way was just seen as an incredible insult. To act in, just let me finish. It was seen and felt as an incredible insult to the family and to the elders. Just like, just extraordinarily blunt and rude, discourteous. Just like going up and slapping your grandmother in her face. And I use that analogy deliberately. Because that seems to be how it was felt like. And so, the reaction of immediately cutting Bodhinyana Monastery off without, not saying, well, let's have a trial period or we need to discuss this further or whatever. It felt to me like it was in response to the kind of insult, really. And quite honestly, just from Ajahn Brahmawangsa's conversation with Lumpur Samedo in England and then other conversations with Ajahn Chandika and so on, it seems that he Ajahn Brahm really, really did not understand the degree of offence that would be felt by his elders and the Sangha in Thailand. He really did not. As Ajahn Pasano wrote him a little note just after the ordination happened, saying, I think you, to quote George W. Bush a few times, that you could. That you seriously misunderestimated. Very few times you can quote George Bush effectively. But it was a sweet little note. So I think you seriously misunderestimated the reaction of the Sangha in Thailand. He seems to have misread it. And it's like, slapping your grandmother in the face and then, why is everyone so upset? What did I do something wrong? And I'm not trying to trivialize it, but it's really that's the kind of degree of sort of shock. And how could he do that? Like, what? And that so obviously for it's not the same for everyone. But that's, to me, that's where that very radical reaction came from. It was just the degree of just. Of just rudeness and discourteous, just the disrespect. So, what we have before us is starting on Monday, Ajahn Chandika and I will be at the alternative World Abbots meeting, so that we'll be visiting all of these things, and a lot of this will be in the air.
I wonder how the women feel.
The nuns themselves, well, I've been thinking about them from the beginning, and that was my first thought, honestly. And Ajahn Vayama and the others, how they've been really caught in the wheels, and it's such a multi-layered and multifaceted issue. There's just so many different dimensions to it. That it can really get the papancha mill, the conceptual proliferation, going. But I can't second guess. I'm not there. I'm not in contact with them. I sincerely hope that they're able to practice with the situation, and also that there's. That there's compassion and understanding in the mix, as well as the patriarchy.
Does the monastic community take into consideration the feeling in terms of the laity, in terms of what the feeling is, in terms of what's happened to these to Ajahn Brahm and his excommunication, and the attitude towards the equality in terms of men and women, and if we would take, I don't know what the vote would be in terms of wanting equality for men and women in the situation, we looked at this laity and tried to get a response as to what their feeling was. Would the monastic community take that into consideration?
Well, I hope so. It's a there's a petition that's been circulated that more than 2,500 people have signed.
Do we have a copy here?
I have a printed copy at Bimuti that I've been asked to take to the meeting of letters people have written and the entire list of signatories for the petition.
And the petition asks or states what's its view?
I can't recite it off the top of my head, but it's
generally,
we are disheartened at the decision of expelling Ajahn Brahm, and we've disheartened. The first four points begin: we are disheartened and disagree with the expulsion of Ajahn Brahm and Bodhinyana Monastery, and the position of Wat Bapong and the elders of negating or denying the validity of the nun's ordination, and it's asking for reconciliation and dialogue to begin, and also dialogue including the voices of the lay community. So
my proxy.
Sure. I was asked to carry the petition, and it's also a couple of hundred letters that go with the names on the petition, and and then comments that have come from many other people as well. Whether people will read them, I don't know. I feel that the voices are certainly to be listened to, and that if the elders say, so let us lay people, what do they know? That I would be extremely saddened by that. I'm sure there'll be some who absolutely would never think that way, but there might be some who do. I personally agree to take the petition. I'll do my best to present it and to see that those voices are heard, because it's pretty much, I mean, I live in California, so it's the idea of equality and equal representation is extraordinarily widespread. But it's also important to, there's a few things within that I should say in terms of equality, because I don't know if people realize, but if you follow the pattern laid down in the nun's Vinaya, that the first Garu Dhamma, like the eight conditions that the Buddha put in place to when he agreed to start the nun's order in the first place, number one is a nun who's been ordained for 100 years must pay respects to and get up for and will consider herself as junior to a monk who's even been ordained that day. Rule number one. That still pertains. So the idea of equality, even if you're a fully ordained nun. Now that might be appalling in the eyes of the people in the West. That's there in scripture and in tradition. And if you want to move that one out of the way, then you've got to change the view of the whole of how things have been practiced in Asia, back into the mist of time.
But nothing is permanent.
Nothing is permanent, but I'm just for people to know that that's the case. And also, many people are sort of been approaching this in terms of sort of bhikkhuni ordination, they're not really thinking about the real people. I mean, I was glad that our friend here mentioned that about what about the women themselves, because like I've been very closely connected with the 10 precept nuns of Amaravati in Chidhurst. You know, I was I've been in that community since before that that ordination was created back in 1983, and I know all of the nuns, you know, up until the last. I've been living abroad for the last 13 years, but all of the ones who were ordained prior to that I know very well, and so I collaborate with them a lot. Every retreat that I teach in the US, I co-teach with some of the nuns or one of the laywomen teachers. I have done for nearly 20 years. So I know them well. And most of them don't want to be bhikkhunis. Surprise, surprise. And the reason is because we're a strict Vinaya tradition. If you strictly keep the bhikkhuni rules, your life becomes very, very restricted. If you're outside the monastery, if you were a bhikkhuni, you couldn't travel away from the monastery without another bhikkhuni with you. And you have to be within 4 arms distance at dawn with another nun. Otherwise, it's a very, very serious transgression. It's a Sanghari Sesa rule. So effectively, you have to sleep side by side with another nun if you're outside the monastery. That's the rule. So if you are asking the Siladharai, you should be campaigning for bhikkhuni ordination, you're also campaigning for them to live in a very restricted way. Now, again, you might say, well, we can change that one. Yeah. But those are issues that are in the air as well. But if we're going to do this, we want to do it properly. We don't want to be half-hearted. So, are you ready for Sanghari Sesa 3? Do you really want to live that way? Or not? So those are issues. They're all part of the mix. So that if it's not just a theory, that if the nuns really, and some of them are prepared to take on bhikkhuni ordination because of the cause and how it would benefit people in the long run, but there's aspects of the bhikkhuni training which are extraordinarily limiting in modern times. And one of the things that people don't necessarily understand is that the Siladhara training that's been crafted at Amaravati at Chidhurst is they've taken most of the bhikkhuni rules that apply in the modern age and rules from the Bhikkhu Patimokkha and established a training around the ones that work and haven't put into place the ones that will be that limiting, like the Sanghari Sesa 3. So their training is actually more tailor-made to life in the modern world than the monk's training is. And, you know, we have a few rules that are kind of, you know, a bit strange or don't really apply in this age. Theirs is actually much more custom-made. So that's a part of the mix that it's important to understand. That it's not just sort of, okay, you get the ordination and there's total equality. There's a lot of other factors that are playing in there. And also real people. I think it's important. Even my sisters, we're talking about, and I care about them, and so I think it's important just to not be having an eye just on the principle, but also the lives of these people and their efforts towards liberation. What's really going to conduce to liberation? And that, I can't pretend that I've thought it all through and figured out. I figured out how to do it. Ding. But I'm glad to be a part of this whole mix. I have no idea where it's going to go. I feel mixtures of trepidation and interest. But it's a balancing act. There's a hand at the back. Yes, please.
Ajahn, could you please explain what are the bases that why bhikkhuni's rule are so strict compared to monks' rule?
In the Buddha's time, before he established his order, there were a number of women wanderers, samanas, or paribhajikas, and that they seem to have been very few in number, and they didn't have doesn't seem to have been particularly organized training for them. For the Buddha to establish the bhikkhuni order, was an almost completely unique and radical act. So in order for, this is my guesswork, and maybe Ajahn Chandika or Ajahn Jaya can kind of add to it or change it, that in order to get accepted, because the Buddha was also not just an incredibly wise being, he was also very pragmatic, and he was quite savvy in terms of politics. And so if he realized that he had tremendous power, and a lot of people would go along with what he did and what he said because he was just like, he filled space with his presence and his incredible peacefulness and clarity. He knew he carried a lot of clout. But when he was gone, what would be a structure that could stay in place that would enable the women's training to survive? So my feeling is that he put that, particularly the first Garu Dhamma, about all the nuns, every nun being junior to every monk, that he put that in place and wouldn't move it, because shortly afterwards there was a suggestion, well, maybe it would be better if we kind of went in order of reigns when we were ordained. And he said, no, can't change it. Because if there was more equality in that respect, that he saw that the nun's order would have been completely wiped out. That the society would not have stood for it. That there would have been, because it was too far out of keeping with the ordinary mores of society. But by having the nuns as officially junior, that was kind of okay, we can allow that to happen. And so that just the organization could hold together without his presence to be like a guardian thing. Many of the other rules, like sleeping within a forearm's distance of another nun, is to do with safety. You know, basically, even as it is today, unfortunately, that in many places in the world, that if a woman goes by herself out into the countryside, she's walking through the forest, or she's alone, she's going to get attacked. That's the cause for those rules being laid down, were that nuns were being attacked and raped, and so that those were established as for protection and for trying to hold the livelihood of nuns together. Originally, the nuns used to live out in the forest, just like the monks did. But then, because Upalavana was attacked, the Arahant Upalavana, she was attacked and raped, and then and I believe that was the cause for the Buddha to say, no, the nuns Upasaya, the nuns' residences should be close to the city walls. So if you go to Savatthi in India, you can see the old city walls of the city of Savatthi, the place where the nuns' monastery was, the Upasaya, is, it's right by the eastern, just outside the eastern gate, right up against the walls, because they found that if the nuns were living off in the forest, it was too dangerous. They were coming to harm. So many of those rules, so when it took about 7 years in England from the time that Ajahn Sumedho first gave the 10 precept ordination to the nuns, that Ajahn Sujito and the nuns in over that 7 year period, they worked out a training for themselves, the Sila Dhara training. And I was his sideman, I was his kind of like the sort of Ajahn Jodhipala to Chandigarh kind of thing. I was the silent sidekick. I find it hard to believe that I was the silent one, but I was the silent sidekick. Well, Ajahn Sujito and the sisters crafted that training, and so we went through the whole thing, piece by piece by piece by piece. So that's why I'm quite well versed in the Bhikkhuni Patimokkha, because, you know, I was part of that whole thing. And so choosing which rules apply, which ones don't apply, okay, we take this one and we can adjust it that way. And because it was being created from scratch, we could kind of make it up as we went along. So it was much more tailored to, okay, now we don't sort of have to walk through the countryside, we can go on transport and public transport. Now, how should nuns be ready and be able to travel? Do we consider being on public transport being accompanied, etc., etc.? So that the Sila Dhara training is much more comparable to the Bhikkhu training in many ways. They don't use money, they eat from alms bowls, they carry out their ceremonies in Pali and so on, and have shed a lot of those restrictive and no longer really applicable rules that related to the role of caste or the inferior status of women in Indian society, and so on and so forth, and that make it much more tailor-made. So to the people, I must say, when I see some of this correspondence and the things being put out, you know, the Sila Jaras shouldn't be held down to their miserable 10 precepts, they should be lifted up. It's like, well, thank you very much. You know, it's like getting, you know, being an executive in a company and then getting promoted to being the, you know, the chairperson who has no power. You know, it's like, okay, well, thanks, I got a higher rank, but you're encumbered with a lot of stuff you don't really need, and you can't really do the things that you want to do so easily. Maybe that's not the perfect analogy, but you could probably get the point.
I'm not a mayor sure in this, but what I want to point out that we should take into consideration the fact that Buddha was initially very reluctant to ordain nuns.
Yeah.
I think, you know, he rejected it twice and it's third time in Ananda. And the second point is that after the ordination, Buddha did mention to Ananda that because the bhikkhuni order was established, that the Buddha's asana won't last more than 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes, those are all part of the mixture.
What was the idea of that? Why was this stated? I'm sure he must have had good reason for that.
I don't know. I mean, second guessing the Buddha is not. I find I do it quite often, but I always have this feeling of like I'm, you know, walking onto delicate territory. Yeah, to second guess the Buddha. I think he realized this is so radical. Like, yeah, do you realize that the Buddha is the only leader of an establisher of a world religion who actually created anything for women? He's the only one. Muhammad didn't do it. Jesus didn't do it. Yeah, Moses didn't do it. You know, the Buddha was, he realized this is incredibly radical. This is to take women and give women a space in the world where they're out of the kitchen, out of the birthing world, out of the mothering world.
In India.
And he's like, this is, okay, this is going to be an enormous pill to swallow. This is like swallowing a whale. You know, this is really a big deal. I really don't feel I should second guess the Buddha. But I think he also saw, particularly to the Brahmin ascendancy, the Brahmin aristocracy, like, they are going to absolutely, they're going to go berserk.
Just like the Thai monks.
That's what, yeah. You said that, I didn't say that. But that's, I think he realized this is just so radical. But then also he agreed to do it. And then from then on, it's like he didn't want to teach any humans at all in the first place. You know, he was reluctant to teach anybody, right? Until the Brahmas, I mean, you did the Brahmacharloka.
Yes.
That's the Buddha said, no one's ever going to understand this. I'm just going to go off and have a peaceful abiding on my own. So he was reluctant to teach anybody. So the Buddha's reluctance is not unique to starting the women's order. Yes? So he just realized this societally, this is gigantic. And the Brahmins are going to go berserk. But okay, he was never upset about upsetting the Brahmins. There's quite a few instances where he was, you know, happy to give him a good poke. But he realized on a societal level, this is huge, and it seems as though that even within his lifetime, like Ananda was chastised. After the Parinibbana, one of the 5 points that Ananda was chastised for was that he persuaded the Buddha to start the nun's order. To me, that's incredible. That you've actually got... to me, that says there was such a conservative element, even within the Sangha, that as soon as the Buddha's passed away, then it's like, you shouldn't have done that, Ananda. It's your fault. we've got these women. You know, it's amazing. And then it's also incredible that it's honest enough to put it in the scripture and keep it there. Right? I mean, there's a number of things that are like that. The Vinaya particularly holds those things. It seems to have been fiddled with a lot less than some of the suttas. But there's some things that it's like, I can't believe they recorded that, you know. But that it's one of the five points Ananda was chastised for. One was not asking the Buddha to live for the rest of the kalpa. Another was that when he was sewing a robe for the Buddha, he put his foot on it, touched it with his foot, and other things like that. But the fact that he was chastised, and that, you know, it's like the nuns are actually having to see this in the book, and then okay. But recognizing that on a social level that was really difficult, he saw that it was worthwhile doing, and as the logic that Ananda put to him, you know, are women capable of realizing the fruits and attainments of Sotapanna, Sakadagami, Anagami, Arahantship? He said yes. So then, on that basis of realization, then that was the basis on which the Bhikkhuni order was established. So, you know, that's how I see it. And this is a subjective impression. I'm not an expert. I have a loud mouth. But, you know, it's how I see it. I also have great faith that there's a way through this, that there can be that genuine faithfulness to the original intent of the Buddha, the elders of the tradition and people who've gone forth in faith over the centuries, and also a faithfulness to these current times. It's impossible to predict at least to me. I don't have the dibhachaku, or the eye that can see into the future. But I feel there's enough intelligence and goodwill, and hopefully enough flexibility to be able to take this current conflict, you know, it's like a family argument on a grand scale, and work it out. I think there's tremendous spiritual resources that are available in the lay community and in the monastic community. So,
Mante, what about forgiveness? You tired us know about forgiveness.
Oh yes, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Just pray. No, I'm not entirely joking. You know, I think it's all goodwill and sending forth the intent, sharing the merit of your life and your good actions, dedicated towards the cultivation of forgiveness and understanding. You know, one of the interesting thing about the Thai language is that the word apai in Thai means forgiveness. So our monastery, the meaning of our monastery name becomes Forgiveness Mountain, rather than Fearless Mountain. So that many Thai people think that our monastery is about forgiveness, but it's because it's the when you forgive someone, then you don't need to be afraid of them. So abhayadana is when you forgive someone, it means they don't have to be afraid of anything from you. It's also, maybe, I see it's now 9:45, and probably, I'm sure knees are getting sore, but there are people who are wanting to head home. But not that I wish to gain any more votes for myself, but I'll say it anyway, is that one of the reasons I chose the name Abhayagiri for the monastery that I established in the US is precisely because it was the origin of the nun's order. We were given the land where we are by Master Xuan Hua, who's a Chinese, he passed away in 1995, but he established a very large community in the USA, has many, many thousands of disciples in Asia. The City of 10,000 Buddhas is the largest Buddhist community in the USA. It has probably about 70 or 80 nuns, about 20 monks. Has four schools and a university, high schools, girls and boys high school and junior schools, and a university. It's a resident community of over 200 people. He was the one who donated, in the spirit of sort of interlineage generosity. he was the one who donated 120 acres of land, and that's why we are where we are. Just before he passed away, he offered the half of the forest where we are at Abhayagiri. And so I was trying to ponder a name that would both be in Pali and then also respect the gift that Master Wahad made to us. And because in the Chinese world, the nuns outnumber the monks 5-1, generally. And so whenever they have an ordination ceremony, like just in October they had an ordination ceremony, there's 21 nuns and 3 monks. That's kind of normal proportions. In Taiwan, I think it's about 5-1, nuns to monks. And also the acting patriarch, when Somdet Buddhajan went to Taiwan, he made note of the fact that the nuns' monasteries are much better run than the monks' ones are. that's the patriarch of Thailand, the acting supreme patriarch of Thailand, had that impression. But I thought, well, what would be a good name? Years and years ago, I'd read this Edward Conze's book, The Short History of Buddhism, and it talked about Abhayagiri Monastery. And how Abhayagiri was a monastery that welcomed all the different lineages of Buddhism, and that, and it was one of those things that the name just really appealed to me, and I always remembered it, and then I found out from Venerable Ananda Maitreya that he said that the nuns who went from Sri Lanka, the Venerable Devasara, and her group of 12 nuns, they came from a nuns branch of Abhayagiri Monastery. So I thought, well, the nuns' order is the strongest connection between Theravada and the Chinese tradition, and the nuns such a dominant presence in the Master Hua's community and in the Chinese Buddhist world. Maybe that would be a good name for the monastery because it reflects that connection, and refers directly to the origin of the current lineage of the order of Buddhist nuns in the world that are such a strong presence in Master Hua's community. So that's why I chose, one of the reasons I chose the name Abhayagiri, also because the name Fearless Mountain is kind of memorable and no one else had used it. there's lots of Bodhinyanas already. So that it was out of a sense of connection to that lineage and that source that I chose the name. Enough for the evening? Okay, so whatever's been said that's useful, please take it and keep it, and whatever has been not useful, then please leave it aside. And so all of my comments are made with all great respect for all our different communities from the West, from the East, from white, black, yellow, pink, green, blue, purple, all of us. We're a human family and we're all in this together. So may we use the energy of this opportunity to help genuinely liberate the heart from all greed, hatred and delusion.